In a world of podcasts, you are listening to... You're listening to Weird Christian Twitter, the podcast, with your hosts, Amy, Andrew, and Finchface.
I think we're 5 years away from being extinct.
Oh, Earth is ghetto. Oh, Earth is ghetto. Oh, Earth is ghetto. I wanna leave.
Hey guys.
Hey.
Hey.
What's the happy hap?
We missed you last time.
And I miss both of you, so you're like both in the doghouse as far as I'm concerned, to be honest. This is amateur hour, really.
I am so upset that I missed Kristen's interview, but
she didn't ask about you. I mean,
no, she didn't. Who's Andrew again? What's his tag on Twitter?
It's fine. I'm no Hunter Crowder. Like, oh, I don't need the attention. This is not about me. Thank you, Finch, because this is about you, WCT community. How do you like that virtue?
Smooth.
So
smooth.
It was really good, though. I am so glad that Elsie Lauren was on.
She killed it.
I mean, you all. It was great. And I was telling Amy Finch yesterday that I was like, my word, we need to do an episode of the content about what Christian Twitter has done to the gatekeepers.
Yeah.
Like, that was just like, oh, such a good conversation. But anywho, so what you guys doing? What drinking the usual?
Yeah, got my vodka. So especially coffee. Never without a drink of alcohol when we're doing a podcast. Got your black water.
I got my black water coffee mug per use. I was going to say,
shout out to Purple Door Coffee in Denver. Not sure if it's still there.
We don't do advertisement, you muffin.
I got advertisers. No, I'm just kidding.
Shout out Purple Door. But, I mean, why would they not? I mean, maybe they'll sponsor us. They're going to sponsor us now. Shout out Purple Door Coffee. Where are they at?
So they were in Denver. Actually, I don't even know if they're still there anymore, but they used to take runaway teens and teach them how to be baristas and run a coffee
really?
Shop.
Really?
Yeah, pretty cool
stuff. Yeah, stuff like that.
Where was it? Where was this at? Detroit?
Denver.
Denver, Colorado. Let's see. Purple Down Door Coffee. They do still exist.
Nice. Yeah. I used to live right next to them. So, yeah.
Coffee saves lives. Hell yeah, it does. Absolutely. Mm. Speaking of saving lives, have you guys met Jesus?
Oh, nice. Is that what you call a Jesus joke?
I thought you were going to pivot to Don Broomer, how I met him, and he saved my life.
Tell us. Yes.
Yeah,
I've been meaning to tell you guys. Tell us.
So, you know how it's like, it's been a long time. So like, you know, the humor's kind of lost on me a little bit, but I want to tell you the story of how my wife and I, whenever we go on vacation, we kind of go through like the 5 stages of grief, right? Where we kind of live in denial. We don't really pack or prepare very well. And then we get to Charleston. And the only reason I knew Don lived in Charleston was because I thought he lived in Maine.
Geographically, that is like a massive distance.
They're right there together.
Mm. Yeah. So I was actually getting some like, you know, vacation ideas for the fall from him. And he was like, no, I live in Charleston, you idiot. And I was like, oh, I'm actually in Charleston next week. So we exchanged numbers and all this stuff. And Megan and I get to Charleston. We get our rental car. We drive to the house that we're going to stay at. And I don't know what you guys do when you're on vacation or holiday. But Megan and I, we'll scope out the place that we're staying and, you know, unload the car before we go get supplies, right?
Yeah.
So baby Finch Face is asleep in the back of the car. And I'm like, I'm going to leave the car running. And it's one of those, like, you don't have to, like, there's nowhere to put the key. It's just the fob, right?
And then a press button?
Yeah. And then I have the fob. I open up the trunk to unload it. And I set the key inside the trunk for a second. I was like,
no.
Whoa, that's bad.
Oh, no.
I can't do that. I can't do that. So I set it on top of the car, and, you know, I was like, whew, that was close. And then I unload the car, and I, you know,
I know where this
go
is going.
We go out to Sam's Club. Now, if you're following at home, the part that you missed is I never got the key fob off the top of the car. So I peel out onto the highway.
Did you hear it fly off?
I remember I was driving and I heard like a and I was like, oh, that was weird. But I didn't register what I had just done. I drive, I kid you not, 20 miles. The car is still running and I don't have a key fob. And so my wife and I would get to Sam's Club in North Charleston and turn the car off. And immediately I was just like, something's not right here.
No.
And so I start like rooting around looking for the key. And I was like, oh my gosh, did I? And then it goes off, like the key is at the house. And so I text Don because we had exchanged numbers. I was like, you know, having anxiety and all the things. And I text him. He bails me out. He takes me back 20 miles my place.
Really?
He actually super nice about it. So shout out to Don.
Don, I mean, that's great to know because his Twitter activity is phenomenal, nice,
so
and sweet.
This is literally like a 6-hour like thing because so he takes me back and he like helps me look for it because he just like can't believe like he's like I this guy's he's so gracious about it, but I know in the back of his mind he's like
this is
guy
your first
is
interaction with a Twitter friend.
and so a funny story is we're driving to my place and I was like, I got the directions pulled up on my GPS and he was like, oh, I don't need directions. And I was like, he's either about to murder me because he didn't take that turn or, you know, he really does know where he's going. So shout out to Don. He didn't murder me. But
that's good news.
So
I was going to ask.
We found
if he
the
did.
Keys. We I oh, get
you
the
found
car.
It? That's good.
Yeah, we found the key fob, and it was just a nightmare. And he was, like, such a calming voice the whole time, because I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to have to buy this rental car.
Oh, we all need to marry a Don, don't we?
So,
well, at least your friend like Don.
So we now need – this is incredible, Finch.
What,
we now
so
need Don on.
Here's the kicker, real quick. My wife, who's a Luddite, absolutely hates all things social media.
She
turned to me at the end of the night and I said these words, thank God for Twitter.
That's the best part of the story.
That's awesome. So I finally got to tell her about my second family and all things are good. It's fantastic. So
best.
Shout out to Mrs. Finch.
You know what? I'm serious. You know, shout out to everybody. No shout out. You don't get a shout out if you say Twitter's not real life. That's incredible story, Finch.
That's a real, yeah.
Yeah, speaking of just the great connections of Twitter, I think, Amy, you recently interviewed Lisa Congo, right?
I did. We had a lovely time. I've just been re-going over the podcast, actually, the interview. And, it was really cool. It was really nice. Just two ladies chatting about theology. No message over having to be authority over us. We're just
That's awesome. Well, I was thinking that let's do this episode. Let's share that interview with you and Lisa. And before we do, we have a message of an incredible church story that we want to share. So we'll share that and then Lisa's interview.
When I was around 9 years old, I went to this church where they thought the best way to talk about the New Testament Jesus was to talk about the Old Testament sacrifices first, which makes sense. But what they would do is they would take this adorable little stuffed lamb. I remember it looking exactly like lamb chop. They would take a bag of strawberry jelly and they would put it inside of this lamb and sew the lamb back up and then start going into a lesson. And they would pull out the stuffed animal and we would all awe over it, whatever. And then they would take a knife and stab the lamb in front of our faces while strawberry jelly just oozed out of the gaping wound. It was definitely a memorable lesson, not the best lesson, but it stuck with me.
I feel like a bit rubbish on my own because usually Andrew's like the American who's just like, hi guys, how's everyone doing? Like, and I'm like, yes, anyway, let's talk. So I apologize for the non-fancy, non-American introduction and stuff. But yeah.
That's good. They're a frenetic amount of energy. So maybe it's a good pace for a Sunday morning.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's good to have you on, so thanks for coming and stuff.
Thanks.
So, yeah. I mean, just to say that obviously I just read your thesis you sent me, or whatever we call them, I never know. I'm a master's student, I still don't even know all the names of stuff, but it's a thesis, isn't it? Isn't that what you're, the thing you're going to argue, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so. That's what we did in May. Yeah, so.
That was interesting. Really interesting. Yeah. So I'd love to talk about that. So there's a couple of things I wanted to talk about, like some of your work, obviously, as much as you can talk about that.
Sure.
You know, how we met and how this podcast came about, which is obviously Weird Christian Twitter. And then a little bit about, your dissertation and your ideas, because I think that's fascinating. And actually, I think that they come together actually quite well in terms of the pandemic and how Weird Christian Twitter has kind of kicked off, and obviously your work, because obviously we know each other and stuff, so I know what you do, and how that sort of falls in line with that as well. I'm sure that's all been sort of part of your journey to that ideas. So why don't we kick off nice and lightly and talk about Weird Christian Twitter. Let's do that first. That's let's ease ourselves in gently.
Which seems very not on brand for Weird Christian Twitter, actually.
Yeah, and I just have to apologize.
It's more like a megaphone.
Yeah, apologize that Andrew and Finch are not here, because clearly Andrew's doing, inverted commas, house church. So obviously he's just a half pagan now and pretending that he does church in his house, whatever, while drinking vodka, I'm sure. Joking. And Finch is apparently drywalling, so with a mate on a Sunday. So he's working on the Lord's Day. So whatever, take that what you will, people. They told me to rag on them. So I've done it, boys.
It's up to the women. It's up to the women once again to bring the holiness and the sanctification to this. Yes.
Exactly. Exactly.
I will cross it and make it holy. Yes.
Yeah. So, let's talk about Weird Christian Twitter. Like, how did you find it? Like, what's the crack with that? Like, how, whatever you want to say, really.
My origin story?
Yeah, go for it.
Well, my origin story with Weird Christian Twitter. So I had Twitter, but wasn't active on it since 2009, which I think is actually a pretty common theme for a lot of people I've been hearing. They're like, yeah, I've had it for years, but couldn't figure it out. Didn't want to bother. And then when the pandemic hit, obviously we're all locked inside and looking for alternate ways to kind of make connections and stuff. And Facebook was becoming more and more of a dumpster fire, especially as the pandemic went along, that I was like, I need to carve out a space that so I'm super mindful about who I add as friends, like who I follow and things like that on Twitter, because I wanted a space that didn't have a whole lot of in real life or church people there, because I knew I wanted to process a lot of church stuff and didn't want my pastors, obviously watching all of that, because I didn't want them to feel badly because I was in process and didn't know where I would end up with stuff. So started getting active on Twitter. And then the first like engagement I remember was watching the whole Andy's from Australia's video about Marmite.
No, it's not Marmite, is it? Vegemite.
Vegemite. Vegemite. And watching that and then just seeing the interactions and stuff was like, these are really fun people. And Ames from from the States, we got connected and started kind of chatting a little bit in DMs and stuff. And then it just kind of blew up from there. And, it, you know, getting in close with Ames was like providential because she's like the social queen of WCT. So I ended up getting corralled along with everything and ended up meeting everybody. So, and have loved it. It's a great, messy community.
Well, that's cool. That's kind of similar to my story, really. Like it's Ames, Ames is a gatekeeper, but in a good way, but not a gatekeeper. But do you know what I mean? Like, you know, she meets you at the gate and welcomes you as opposed to slams the door in your face. That's used that analogy, shall we? So,
absolutely.
Amazing. So that's cool. Oh, cool. Okay.
I actually don't know anybody who's as good at building community as she is. And I think that's been a big part of WCT is that intentional, like bombing people with like a million people in a thread to welcome them. And people just get like enveloped in really quickly, which is awesome. Yep.
And I think that is important, isn't it? Because I remember when I started, it was like, you see these people, they're having jokes. You kind of get, you get it, but you don't. I mean, I got it less because obviously I'm British, so a lot of it was stuff. And I was like, I don't really get what who these people they're talking about. But I could, I, you know, I was like the kind of person that could make a joke like it. And so I kind of got in there. But, you know, yeah, Amy's great for that in terms of, you know, people were tagged and then you felt welcome. You felt like, oh, someone's that is you. People started adding you and stuff. So, you know, that's really important in a community, isn't it? That you just feel included, even if you're on the outside for a while, the more you put in, the more you get out. But you have to be included first before you put in because it's intimidating, isn't it? Like, you know, with people you think look like they know what they're talking about and know what they're, you know, chatting and in jokes and stuff. So, yeah, no, she's brilliant at that. So that's cool, So just to, you know, obviously you're not American. Let's just put that out there. That's we're not, I'm English, UK, and you're Canadian. So we're not even talking to Americans this time.
That is right.
Well, and
British Empire represented.
Yeah, exactly. Commonwealth. So yeah, that's cool. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about like what you do for a living and yeah. And your Christianity in that respect, because obviously I know a little bit, but it'd be great to, you know, tell people, what's that? Yeah. What's your life look like basically? Yeah, for
sure. Sure. So, so I actually am a pastor by education. So, have been to seminary, just graduated with my master's in theology there. And so, I actually was a pastor, prior to, where I'm at right now, but about, I don't know, probably about 2005 or 2006, was recognizing that, my church had a ceiling in terms of what they would allow women to do in regards to their leadership and kept trying to push that, kept trying to break that, and then recognized really quickly if I was still going to retain love for the church, I needed to leave because I was, it was going to be a more and more frustrating experience. And so ended up in the social services field at that point and found actually a really good alignment between, you know, a pastoring vocation and a shepherding heart and what social services is or ought to be. And so started down that road, have worked with a few different organizations, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Boys and Girls Clubs. And then most recently, I have been actually that my first day of work was the first day of lockdown, running a women's shelter here in Calgary where I live. So we're a second stage shelter. So we, women come out of the emergency shelters and obviously need more support and space and safety to be able to continue healing. And so we're a year program where women and their children can come in. We have a 24 building apartment, a 24 apartment building. And so women can come on site for a year and get like wrap around all sorts of services and basically just a safe place to land to kind of start to figure out what the future looks like for them and for their children. And then we have, we also have a Canada's first trauma-informed daycare and preschool that we off that we run on site as well. So obviously we serve the children in residence in that, but also public families, so community families in the greater Calgary area that come as well. So yeah, that's awesome. What I'm doing right now. Yeah. And I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so Christ-like, isn't it? And, you know, like, because you do need that, obviously, instant emergency care, which is like, bam, get out straight away, just need a house, just need some food, just need shelter, just to get out, that panic moment. But actually, then you need the next step, which actually, well, now I need to start working out how my life looks like, because it's going to look totally different. And so that's just such an amazing place to be, like, you know, it's, I just think that's, yeah, that's just amazing. That's so cool, like to be able to offer that service to people, really. Like, and do you have like statistics of like success rate after that because of them going then to the next stage and long term of coming out of those kind of environments, or not really?
Not yet. So the domestic violence sector internationally is actually really young in terms of a social service support. So a lot of these other, so say Boys and Girls Club or things, they're like 100 and some years old, right? Whereas the domestic violence sector is only been a thing since the late 1970s. So it's actually quite young in terms of its development and its studies and its research. So there's lots of research going on and longitudinal kind of studies going on right now, but we're still in the process of gathering some of those to look at, like, what are the long-term outcomes and successes for women that have these extra supports. And then I think they need more support even than what we're offering right now in terms of their reentry back into communities and stuff like that. So that's a program we're actually working on right now. Is we have a family systems counselor who's helping to, a part of what we're hoping to have that person's role will be, is as a lady, like 3 months before they exit, we'll be reaching out and engaging with that woman's natural community and saying, here's what has happened. Do you want to be a part of her future and creating a safe, healthy new reality for her? And then inviting them into doing group support stuff so that the community that they're exiting into, that are going to be their primary supports, have some education and some support themselves to really help make that transition really, really healthy for the women that go. But it's, you know, anecdotally from what we have seen, our ladies do really, really well once they leave. Yeah. I think there's still a lot more we could do to better support women, and well, not just women, people who've experienced family violence, for sure.
No, because I was just thinking, you know, in terms of female liberation and, you know, feminist movements, you know, you're only talking 1950s, 1960s, you know, in the, and, you know, we're only talking in the West as well. So, you know, patriarchy kind of attitude still very deeply woven, and probably less so in the world than in the church. But I think sometimes it's also a very individualistic society. So that's probably quite hard in terms of, you come in, like, you've got this community that's looked around, like they say, wraparound care, cared for you. But when you go out into the community, you might have already been ostracized because you were with an abusive partner. You know, where, you know, you might have had a severe lack of community anyway. Where do you get that community from? Traditionally, it was the church. Sometimes churches aren't safe for women that have been in domestic, you know, we hear about that in Weird Christian Twitter, don't we? Where people, you know, have been abused in the church. You know, women have been told to put up with abuse. So do we really want to put, it's not all churches, obviously, of course, you know, I'm not saying that, but, like, you know, it's, we are mindful of that, that is a good, in theory, the church should be a good community to put women that have been abused, but sometimes actually that's not a safe place to be. And so, you know, where do we find community in society? That can be quite hard sometimes. I don't know, I suppose support groups and things.
Yeah, and it is. Yeah, and I think, I mean, a key element of abuse that you see that's very, very common is abusers isolating their people. So yeah, they're not only going out into an individualistic society in our context, but they've also been systematically isolated and you know, had all of those natural supports kind of removed from them, or they've been trained. Their brains have been trained not to trust or believe that those people want them. And so a year of counseling is wonderful, but it's not all that's needed to unwind all of the knots that have been tied into their understanding of health and wellness. So it's a lot of work and a lot of ongoing. So once the ladies leave us, they have 6 months, and actually they can access it even beyond that if they want, but they have 6 months of intentional post exit support and counseling care as well.
Yeah. So I think that's so important, isn't it, in terms of counseling, because you could leave one person that's abusive and just fall back into another person that's totally, it might seem different, but just the same patterns, because, you know, we're human and we have patterns of behavior, don't we? So, you know, it is important for that counseling. It's not just about physical shelter and, you know, and those kind of getting away. It's actually the physiological. Yeah. Physiological needs of a person needs to be fulfilled as well. We, you know, which, you know, come into, you know, your MA thesis and the idea and Christianity as well. And the idea of, you know, one of my passions is what I want to look into more is theological anthropology. So what does it mean to be human? And especially in terms of being a female as well. And so, you know, you doing this work, yes, and then, you know, if you just want to explain what you did for your master's thesis, because I think it's fascinating. I think it's a really important topic now.
Yeah. Yeah. So the topic that I chose is I felt like there was a missing piece of our theology in terms of how we engage with God. And found this term that's used in reference to Greek mythology called theomachy. So it's theo meaning God and mach meaning war brought together. So it was used to describe when in Greek mythology, when the gods and the men, the humans, would war and have contention with each other. And so I kind of co-opted that and used it for our purposes in, you know, Christian kind of theology to look at the thematic kind of study of the Bible to see all of the times where there's contention, complaining, wrestling with God, arguing with God, pushing back and challenge against God. So I feel like there's actually quite a theme from start to finish of that concept in the Bible, and felt like we needed to create not a different branch, but an extra piece of study called theomachology. So the study of contention and wrestling with God. And, you know, obviously watching, you know, the pandemic has kind of been a forced sabbatical for everybody from their faith communities. And I found that it's been rife kind of fodder and ground for people who to start to wrestle with and really think about what they believe and what they've always been taught to believe and what they believe now in the middle of a year that was pretty epic in terms of world events as well, not only the pandemic, but all of this rise of nationalism and populism and stuff like that has really forced people, a lot of people, it's removed kind of maybe rose-colored glasses that they had about their church. And so it's a relevant topic, I think, because it gives a framework of understanding that you're not wrong for doing this. And so I know everybody's exhausted by the term deconstruction. Maybe we need to just call it theomachy from now on. Maybe that's a better term for it. But it's a good time in history, and a lot of people are doing this. But historically, and I know this from my own experience, I'm always getting rebuked for it, always getting in trouble for it, being told it's wrong, being called rebellious, you know, people calling my faith adolescent and immature. You're not really a Christian, you know, having my faith and the integrity of my faith and the authenticity of my faith questioned for it. And actually, I have always felt God really affirming this. And that's the main point of this for me, is that not only is it not bad, but that this is a very useful discipleship tool that God uses to grow people up in their faith and in their relationship with Him. So it's not something bad happens and you just respond out of your immaturity. I believe God starts these fights because they're very effective ways of making us actually very thoughtfully itemize and process and think through our faith to really, you know, He wants to know if we love Him, that we've thought about it and that we choose Him thoughtfully, because there's a lot this side of full revelation that is pretty unpalatable about how God interacts with the world. His sovereignty is super troubling. And I think He wants to know, would you love me if you knew these things about me? And let's talk about that. Do you still love me after? And so theomachy has been an incredibly useful tool for growing. I've never felt at the end of a season of wrestling like it was not time well spent. In fact, I felt like I got propelled like miles ahead of where I was in terms of intimacy with God and greater understanding of who He is. Not that I like everything that I've found, but yeah. It's definitely, you know, grown my relationship with Him. And I think it's really relevant right now as people are, there's a big conversation about deconstruction, right? And what yeah. are these, you know, these pillars of our faith, and do we want to keep them? So, yeah.
No, 'cause I was thinking, you know, in terms of like reading it, and one of the big examples is the Book of Job. So, yes. you know, from certain areas of charismatic worlds that I've been in, not the ones that I'm in now, but ones that I've been in the past, that basically they dismiss Job. And it's pretty much like, we're not going to talk about it because Jesus overrules everything. To put it crudely, like, it's like, yeah, Job, this looks like we're talking about suffering, but we're just going to ignore this because Jesus came and Jesus, you know, said we're going to have heaven on earth, kind of, to put it crudely. So, you know, I was always like, well, I don't, you know, these are kind of things that I've wrestled with in my life. And like, well, I don't, that doesn't sit well with me. So so in the context of Job, could you sort of explain your idea of theomachy, just so we can sort of ground it in scripture so people know what
yeah for sure. So first of all, Job is the oldest. Most scholars are pretty agreed on that. It's the first like scriptural literature that was written down. So it actually predates even Genesis and Moses' work with the Pentateuch and stuff. And so I think that that's relevant, that the first thing that's written should matter a lot and not just be kind of thrown away. And I think that as a topic, it's interesting that that's the first message that God wanted written down, was this idea of life isn't going to be all sunshine, puppies and happy days, that there's other things at work, and how we work through that with God and about God really matters. So Job, the first thing people need to realize with Job, and a lot of people haven't read Job, they only know sort of the basic overview of the story, but they haven't really dug into the book itself. But I'd highly encourage it. It's a troubling book because it starts with basically a wager between God and Satan, like with the accuser, the advocate, the devil.
This character. Yeah.
And so basically the accuser comes into the heavenly throne room and says to God, or no, God says, hey, look at Job. Isn't he amazing? He loves me. He's doing so much good. He's such a good guy. And Satan goes, well, yeah, of course he is, because you give him everything he's ever wanted. Why would he not love you and serve you? And so God's like, good point. Okay. Well, you can take stuff away from him, but you can't. And so there's these series of wagers that happen. And then basically, slowly, these tragedies befall Job, and all of his children are destroyed. His business is wiped out. He's left with literally nothing. And then as a last final, you know, screw you, Job. He gets like hit with this disease that leaves him disfigured and in with open pussy sores all over his body and just disgusting human broken mess. And then it shows, you know, a large part, most of Job is his friends come to him, his church friends come to him and see him so horrified by what's happened to him and what he looks like that they just lose their minds. And for a whole week, just sit in the dust and weep with him and cry for him. And then, like every good Christian, decide they need to somehow do some theological tap dancing to try to explain this reality away and blame the person that's being like left, you know, this broken mess. They somehow are to blame for their situation. So it's a series of conversations back and forth between Job and his friends, where they're trying to say that he's done something to deserve this suffering, right? That God is good. He would only bring good things. You've clearly done something to piss off God, and this is the result. And Job going, no, that's not what's going on. And God is, and it's not, I've always felt like Job isn't addressing his friends. He's talking to them, but he's actually talking to God with his responses.
Did you connect, because obviously I only read your synopsis of thesis or whatever, did you ever connect Adam with Job in terms of like the snake and in the heavenlies pre-fall, especially because of the timing of it, anything like that? I was just like interested.
No, I didn't, but that's an interesting thought. Yeah, no, I didn't.
Like, he went to him and said, well, go then. And that's the same with the snake coming into the garden, which was, is he had the goodness. I don't know, just whether there's a connection there. You didn't read about that. I don't know. I haven't studied Job in any sort of deeper context. So, oh, okay, sorry, carry on. Like, I just wondered if there's any kind of stuff.
No. Like, yeah. Well, and the big thing about this topic is that there's a lot of theological areas of study that intersect with it, right? So theodicy, right? The study of suffering and how suffering is used and where is God in the midst of suffering and things like that, God's sovereignty, all of that. But it's such a big topic to be explored that to try to like, it's, I feel like I'm just at the beginning of kind of mining into all of the connections and the, like, I was just reading in Chronicles today, and it talks about how David brings wants to bring the ark back. And so there's this dancing and this rejoicing, and the oxen starts to stumble. And this guy named Uzzah puts his hand out to stabilize it, and God strikes him dead. And it says David was mad at God for doing that. And I was like, oh, like, I just read a lot of scripture now through that framework. And actually, well, I could pick out the big pieces in scripture, like Job, right? And Jacob wrestling, right? There's these big kind of really on point examples. It's actually really woven quite throughout that this is a very frequent engagement with God, and that he always gets the last word, which is super annoying, but he doesn't smite people for it like the church seems to ought to be dealt with.
His word brings life, doesn't it? So even there's destruction, like do you see destruction after the fall, you see destruction with the Job, regardless of how they come about, but actually at the end, do you tend to see life, like God brings life? That's a lot of the time is the you know, where, like you're saying, the church a lot of the time wants to stay in that death, it wants to stay in the destruction because we deserve it in some kind of but God is greater and God brings life. The flood as well, like after the flood comes life, you know. So
and we're much more comfortable and conversant with, you know, the thematic stuff around redemption and salvation, obviously, because those are super applicable and relevant and nicer. And there's other faith traditions that have an easier time with this concept, but it definitely North American or evangelicalism has a harder time with the darker and the more complicated and complex aspects of engagement or with God or about God. And I think this is definitely one of them, that we are not, our church isn't very strong because we don't have a strong theology of suffering. We don't have a strong theology of wrestling with God and contention with God. And people, I think, are always worried, you know, are people going to walk away from God if they do this? Like, are they being blasphemous? Yes, they are. And God has complete capacity to handle all of that. And there's grace to cover it. And the truth is, he opens the door and says, have you considered life without me? Right? And what if I'm not real? What about that? And the truth is, people can legitimately walk out that door and choose, and they have walked away from their faith, right? And there's a lot of debate right now I've seen on Twitter about, you know, what that means. Was their faith real? Was there, that's just not our business. Like, let people journey their journey and just walk with them. Like, why can't, like, be Job's friends in the beginning? And just be with them, weep with them, listen to them, experience it with them, and shut up and quit trying to speak for him.
Yeah. I think it's, sometimes it's a bit of pneumatology, and I think sometimes our pneumatology in the evangelical church can be a bit rubbish. It's like not trusting. Yep. We're great with redemption in a theoretical sense, but sometimes the pneumatology can be a bit squiffy. So in terms of just the last thing, like in terms of you spoke about the Phoenician women, so obviously your work is in sort of women, and then you wrote about the Phoenician women like wrestling with Jesus to get something, and she did get something. So I don't know how those two things, like how I'm trying to connect them. So sorry, I'm not giving you a very good clear question, but how do you see your work with women? How do you see the liberation of Christ? Like he sees, for example, through the Phoenician woman who wasn't Jewish, she, you know, she wasn't a man. So, you know, both those things, like how do that's not very clear, but do you know what I mean? Like, how do you see your work? How do you see the liberation of Christ and that intersection of your faith for being Jesus being for women and liberating women and also within that suffering, like, if you want to, like, I don't know if there's anything that comes to mind. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that story in particular has always been the one that bugs me the most, because Jesus doesn't come off looking good. And I know a lot of people are like, well, he was trying to be ironic to help his disciples learn. Like, whatever. I think women obviously clearly mattered to God. They mattered to Jesus. And I think with that particular story, he was focused on her and what he wanted to do with her. And her faith actually shocked him. And I think that's where there's a couple of men that get the, whoa, your faith is like that reaction from Jesus where he's like surprised by their faith. But women often were quite surprising to him that they reacted to him, that they reached out to him and engaged with him the way that they did. I think in regards to my work and what liberation and salvation and redemption is the whole point of it. Like, I think redemption is the most beautiful thing actually, when you think about it, that it doesn't, like, to redeem something doesn't mean that you just buy it back at the same price. He bought it back and he gave it an extra, it's higher value now because it's redeemed by him. And so when I look at the stories of the women's lives, and I have a really dear friend of mine who isn't in shelter, but I'm helping her going through hell right now in an abusive situation, a really, really badly abusive situation. And I have such a vision of her life after. And God's going to redeem all of this, and not in the pat churchy way of, I feel like we use this to absolve ourselves of feeling empathetically and compassionately with somebody in the middle, in the process part of their journey. But I believe God is going to buy back this situation, and now it's going to become a part of her power and a tool that he uses to help other women find freedom in the same situation, because nobody can explain the freedom of a situation better than somebody that was in that prison. Right. Yeah. And so that's how I look a lot at the work, because the truth is we can say nice things, we can do all of these great services and wraparound things, and those aren't nothing. Like, we absolutely need to do those. But the truth is, like, that nobody can actually really fix a lot of the really fundamental spiritual things that get broken when somebody is being abused domestically. And it's, domestic violence isn't just physical. It is mental. It is emotional. It can be spiritual. It can be like just damaging to your soul. And one of the most insidious things that I'm recognizing in the work is gaslighting, which I know we reference, right? And that's basically like trying to convince somebody that what they're seeing is happening isn't actually happening. So it makes them question their own instincts and understanding of the world and and it makes them question whether they can trust their inner instinct or guide or what the Holy Spirit in a Christian context is telling them. And so rebuilding that back, humans can't do that work.
Yeah.
Right. So we can get people to a point where they're healed. They have better coping strategies. They have better awareness around how to be safe for themselves and for their families. But really fixing that deep part that gets really broken in a lot of the women that I work with. This is one situation of a lifelong pattern and experience of abuse from the time they were very little. And so their whole understanding of who they are is as somebody who's allowed to be abused and allowed to be used for somebody else's anger or other purposes. And so redefining and reframing who somebody is as a new creation, that's entirely the province of God and redemption. Yeah, so it's very cool. And I don't, our organization is a Christian organization, but we are not all of my staff are Christians, not all of our, we have women of all faiths and backgrounds or no faith in our background. So we are not always overt with that because not everybody comes from a Christian background.
And I imagine it's probably legal stuff as well in terms of the UK.
Yeah, you can't be coercive. So you got to be really careful.
But no, I mean, that's amazing. Person. I mean, that, and that's, you know, going back to Job, you know, it's this idea and your thesis. How do you say it?
Theomachy.
Theomachy, that's it. Sorry. Terrible. That's okay. I can never see anything when I see it, read it. So, you know, your theomachy and the idea of like Job in terms of, just to round out, like, you know, like to not ignore the suffering. God doesn't tell you to ignore the suffering. He's, you know, he's okay if you're questioning and you're pushing and you're frustrated and you're recognizing your painful situations and your hardship. And he doesn't always have answers for those hardships and that suffering. But when people are in the presence of God, or in terms of that the only way that pain can be bring life to it is through God, through the Holy Spirit. And that's what he points to. No, he's not going to answer all your questions necessarily, or, you know, you might not get everything here on this earth, but actually in his presence, that's when life starts to grow. And it might be small and little, you know, it's not like this big bam, you know, I'm a charismatic, so people expect these big massive breakthroughs, but actually sometimes it's small and that slowly grows. And that's obviously now we've got the Spirit, the promise of the Spirit now, and that's a spiritness that slowly grows and grows that even in that pain and uses that pain as well. But we didn't necessarily have that pain and suffering as though God's like some, you know, manic that's like, well, I just gave you that so you can use it. I think it's more complicated than that. But when we have this pain and suffering, that we recognize that, we don't try and hide it, we don't try and protect God's reputation, that's the reality of this suffering, and we can highlight it and we can use, but eventually God can use it, but through the power of his Spirit, not through some, you know, legalistic just squash it down. And I think that's what I kind of took from your ideas, like be bold, speak about the suffering, speak about the theomony. But recognize ultimately that God is the greater being, not the Satan that wanted to do those things. God is greater,
yes,
and he will have redemption in that pain. Did I do that? Is that all right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Does that would you agree
with that? Makes total sense, and I think I do agree with that. And I think the really important thing about the book of Job, which redeems it, is the last little bit where God re-enters, right? So he's right at the beginning, allowing, orchestrating for this to happen. Then he exits the picture, and the entire book is these exchanges back and forth between Job and his friends. And then right at the end, God re-enters back into the story. And he basically, you know, realigns Job back, right? With where were you when I was creating the earth? Oh, right. You weren't there. Yeah. So he realigns this, but the last portion of this is him going, so your buddy's over there. They don't speak for me. If you don't pray to redeem them and if you don't pray for them, I am going to deal with them. And Job prays for them to be saved, and God does not smite them. But the big thing is that at the end of it, God is very clear. All of this barking, trying to protect God, actually really angered him and was not what he wanted. That actually, he's not upset with Job. Job was not, like, they were deeply offended at what Job was saying. God was not. Yeah. And that's actually the best place to go, is that to go to him when you're mad and to be completely open and say whatever you need to say to him. He is the safest person to bring that to, because frankly, he's the one who decided all of this. He's the sovereign one. Who better to answer for it? And so, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. He's the place we go to. And then what is the church's response? Not church in an individual institution, but the church collective. What is our response supposed to be to the people in these situations? It is to create space and to speak when you actually have a word that is going to support that person's journey, to not judge it, because most of the judging in my experience comes from, it's unnerving when people are in these situations, and it's uncomfortable for the people watching it because they're desperately worried that it means that they're going to like pitch it all and walk away. And I would say, even if they do pitch it all and walk away, we still don't know what the future holds for anybody, right? Yeah. Who knows about their journey? So our job with the church is to create space for this, because people are leaving the church in droves because they can't find freedom to ask the questions they feel they need to ask without getting rebuked. So we don't need to rebuke. God's got this covered. He will step in and talk to that person. So every situation season where I've had where it's been really big wrestling, God has always entered into it at some point and realigned me back into the, I'm God, you're not. However, you're not bad. And what you were told about this was not from me, and we're okay. And so I've felt so affirmed and cared for by God. And I just keep thinking, what could that journey be if the church was just better equipped with its theological understanding that this isn't wrong and that actually God starts the fight? What do we do with that then as the body of Christ coming around it, right?
Yeah, no, totally. Well, it's like trust God, and to trust God is to love him, isn't it? And then to love others. So,
yes.
But yeah, no, that, well, thanks ever so much, Lisa. This has been such a blessing, such a good time. And yeah, thank you for coming on. Thank you for coming on to our little podcast.
That was awesome. Thanks. I appreciated the time.
Cheers.
Oh, earth is ghetto. I want to leave.
The very most 10 being extinct.